Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Wesley Burks, Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and a leading national figure, about food allergies.
I am looking forward to this conversation. Maybe we can break down some of the myths and understand it a little bit better.
Have you ever had food allergies?
Not me, but I feel like a lot of my patients are concerned about this. It's in my children's school. It's
really common. I've got family members who believe they have them, and so I'm looking forward to actually getting some information to be able to talk more educated, even with my own family. So I'm looking forward to this. But first, we've got some wonderful research that matters about high blood pressure, and do doctors treat it even when it's right in front of them?
We'll also talk about fatty acid supplements or fish oil supplements. Also about
results might be surprising.
It might be. And about social bullying on TV shows for kids.
Yeah, and more than you may think. And finally, interesting, important article in the New England Journal of Medicine about sugar-free beverages and weight gain.
Let's do the first one first. This is about addressing high blood pressure in the doctor's office. We know this is a really, really common. Heart disease is one of the leading killers in the world and certainly in our country. And blood pressure is linked to heart disease, heart attacks, strokes, et cetera, needs to be treated.
And this study in the Archives of Internal Medicine, Christy, they really looked at, well, how often does a patient come into the doctor's office and actually have high blood pressure, but maybe doesn't go out with a medication for that? And it's probably more than we would be comfortable admitting.
Yeah, so they looked at over 7,000 people with uncontrolled high blood pressure who were participating in a U.S. survey, and then went back and tracked their office visits with a doctor to see what proportion of them were treated for their high blood pressure.
Right, so almost 17,000 visits. And again, these patients were already diagnosed with high blood pressure, and only 1 in 5 actually left the office with a new medication, suggesting that a lot of patients may not be getting the full spectrum of the tools available to reduce their blood pressure. There could be lots of reasons for this, some of which are probably legitimately why doctors don't give new medicines.
And they also couldn't tell from the records if the doctor may have increased the dose if they were already on a medicine. But I think the take-home message here is if you have high blood pressure or if your loved one has high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about it. Don't leave the office without a solid plan for how you're going to reduce that low blood pressure. That high blood pressure.
Because even if you have what's called white coat hypertension, where you kind of get excited when you see the doctor, your blood pressure still could be elevated when you're not in the doctor's office, and that's a problem. So when the nurse takes your blood pressure and you say, is that high? And they say, yeah, it's higher than it should be, or you know that it's higher than it should be, make sure you have a conversation with your doctor, even if you're not there to talk about high blood pressure.
Let's do our next research that matters about fatty acid supplements, looking to see if they reduce heart attacks in high-risk patients.
Yeah, so this study, Christy, that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine, looked at high-risk patients, those who have diabetes or those who have an impaired glucose, and they're at high risk for developing heart disease, and would they benefit from being treated with these omega-3 fatty acids? They're oftentimes seen in fish oil is what a lot of people know them as.
Do you take these, Adam?
I don't, but I've thought about them in the past because I have a lot of patients who do, and some of the patients have high blood triglycerides. And for those, fish oils are one of the ways we can get the triglycerides down. But if you didn't have that, should you be taking such a supplement?
So this looked at over 12,000 patients over 50 years of age, and all of them had heart risk factors plus impaired fasting glucose or sort of pre-diabetes or had diabetes.
And the question that they followed these patients out to see, did they actually have improvements, lower cardiovascular death, lower cardiovascular side effects, heart attacks, arrhythmias? And I would have expected if this was really beneficial in this high-risk group, you would have seen it. But basically, there was no difference between those who took this type of fish oil or sometimes actually flaxseed oil, and those who did not.
And this was a well-designed study. They randomized them to receive it or receive placebo.
And the placebo was actually olive oil. So you might say, well, maybe that hid the effect because the olive oil group also got better. But boy, there are potential side effects of taking fish oil.
Well, not to mention the cost of taking these supplements. And if it doesn't work in the high-risk population, then your average person out there taking fish oil at this point, at least for the
these
heart
particular
disease.
Condition. Right. Well, that's probably not the final word on this, but it is a word. Speaking of words, let's talk about the next research that matters, Christy. Social bullying on TV. What are we talking about?
What we're talking about are these kids, these shows. They're sometimes on Disney or Nickelodeon, they're sort of marketed towards children, and children 2 to 11 years old typically watch these shows, and yet they have a lot of non-physical aggression, insults, taunting, and a lot of picking on people, bullying on TV.
Have you ever seen American Idol, Christy?
Of course,
me too. And when I think about it, there's a lot of social bullying. There's a lot of name calling. There's a lot of taunting. And I think in some respects, actually, that's what turned me off a little bit to the show. But in these researchers, and they published this in the Journal of Communication, they found that 92% of these episodes of TV that they monitored had these incidents of social aggression, and the use of the words accounted for most of this. So it's not the physical aggression, but the social aggression.
Well, and I think sometimes they're in the context of some other moral message of the show, but I have noticed with my children, ages 7 and 4, that sometimes when we try to debrief that show, they don't understand that. And so I don't allow them to watch a lot of those sort of tween shows. I find it pretty sad. And so you should pay attention to what your children are watching on TV, even if it's marketed to children.
And the last one, speaking of paying attention, is some really good research, Christy, in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they actually did a trial of giving children between the ages of 4 years and 11 years 8 ounces of a sugar-free beverage or 8 ounces of a sweetened sugar beverage once a day, and saw what happened over a period of time.
And what they found were that the children who received the sugar-free beverages had reduced weight gain and reduced fat accumulation over time in these normal weight children. You know, this is a disagreement in my family. My sister gives full sugar drinks because she's worried about the sweeteners, the sugar-free, the fake sugar being dangerous. And I would, if we're going to give Kool-Aid, it's going to be sugar-free. And I'm less worried about the sweeteners and more worried about the weight gain. That's such a big problem in our country.
Well, maybe there can be a compromise. How about
water.
Sparkling water? carbonated water there and all kinds of natural flavors. Well, Christy, that'll conclude the research that matters. But I think we both agree that sugar-free beverages for young children in almost all cases are better than the sugar-sweetened beverages, particularly for lessening weight gain.
That social bullying is common in TV shows that kids watch, and we should all pay attention to what our children see on TV.
That fatty acid supplements such as the fish oils may not actually have a benefit, strong benefit, in general use for people if they're really just trying to lower their cardiovascular risk.
And that doctors don't always address high blood pressure in the office. So if you or your loved one have high blood pressure, be sure that you're taking steps and talking with your doctor about a plan.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Wesley Burks about food allergies. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with Chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at the UNC School of Medicine and Physician-in-Chief of North Carolina Children's Hospital, Dr. Wesley Burks, about food allergies. And this is a really common topic that comes up in our office, so we are pleased to have a real expert with us today. Dr. Burks, thanks for being with us.
Christy and Adam, it's nice to be here with you.
Well, we really appreciate it, Dr. Burks. And, you know, you are a nationally recognized figure in this field. And I guess, Christy, I would really like to know and our listeners to know, how did you get really interested in food allergies? I don't think when you say, I'm going into pediatrics, maybe you did, you say, I really want to study food allergies.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. What happened was, like many of us, at different parts in our training, we were influenced by a mentor. And when I was a resident, the person that I emulated and liked did pediatric allergy and immunology. So he actually helped me get my fellowship. And during the fellowship, the person that I wanted to work with, was 30 years ago, was just starting to do some of the initial research in food allergy. And I thought I would have a better training with him. And I did it and really liked it. That's how I've continued to do that.
Well, this is certainly a topic that seems to be coming up more and more in the office and seems to be coming more common over the years. But I'd love to have your perception or your perspective on, is it a perception of food allergies that's increasing, or is it truly that we're having more and more of allergic reactions to food?
Yeah, the answer to both is yes. So it is a perception issue and it is a reality. All allergic diseases are different than they were 20 years ago. There's a rise in each of them: asthma, allergic rhinitis, atopic dermatitis. Food allergy in its perception has kind of outdistanced those for lots of different reasons. Why there's an increase in allergic disease, there's the hygiene hypothesis that we live a too clean lifestyle. There are changes in our microbiome and our GI tract that are different over time. There are the changes in the environment, like with diesel particle exhaust, all reasons that we have more allergic disease. But certainly, it's pretty well documented. The public perception of food allergy, there really is a legitimate increase, but their perception is even beyond that.
So in part then, because I think both Christy and I, we have a lot of people who come to us who believe from a very young age that not only do they have food allergies, but that their children have food allergies. Mm-hmm. And we reviewed some research that suggests that that is an overdiagnosis at times. So help us reconcile these two areas that seem a little bit at odds.
Yeah, no, there are some nice studies that look at the prevalence in the last 10 years, and they ask the appropriate questions. And they're relatively straightforward questions about what type of food you eat and then when you have symptoms. And if followed in that manner, then there's some nice studies that give you some prevalence data. The public perception is probably likely beyond that, 2-3% of young children. And that's what the better studies will show. If you ask just the general lay public, then you get numbers anywhere from 8-12%. So their perception of food allergy is different than their reality, but the reality is different than it was 10-15 years ago.
Wow.
Is that because the symptoms of food allergy are so common that a lot of people have other common things that happen, so they associate these two? I mean, why do people think that it's more common than it is
yeah,
fairly
I think,
common?
You know, one of the things that you see in any, like, parts of medicine as it gets out into the public, the more it gets out there, there's a snowball effect and more people feel like they have symptoms. The symptoms that are really ascribed to food allergy, which are the skin, the respiratory tract, and the gastrointestinal tract.
Like?
Skin symptoms of hives or whelps or urticaria, angioedema, swelling. GI symptoms of vomiting. Pretty severe abdominal pain or diarrhea, but pretty close sequence. And then respiratory symptoms of coughing, but more wheezing and throat-type swelling symptoms, then certainly the wheezing symptoms are common, the hives are common. You know, 15% of the population have hives at some point. So each of those by themselves can be a symptom of food allergy. Usually with food allergy, you have more than one symptom complex. Occasionally, you can have just one of them. But say you have hives, then the default is, well, it's due to foods. Most of the time, it's not at all. It's not related. And you can tell by the clinical history how long the hives last and where they are generally, whether they're related. And because foods, for the most part, don't cause life-ending disease, it's a simple thing medically to listen to somebody say that, and we often don't intervene and ask the right two or three questions to say, yes, you are, or no, you aren't. There's so many other things going on that it's by default pushed aside. And so people continue to have those beliefs and perceptions that we just don't take the time to go into and in a few simple ways to show that they're probably not allergic.
Well, it's also tricky because most of or many of these patients are infants or young children where the parents can't even really ask them and get a straight answer of what is going on. Is their stomach hurting or what those sort of more vague symptoms are really about? So how do you tease that out with parents? What's your approach to sort of teasing out, is it really food allergy or one of these things that can mimic it?
So they're really pretty objective symptoms. The subjectivity, you don't have children, young children having food allergic reaction with subjective symptoms. It's pretty objective that you're going to have hives, you're going to see something, you're going to have swelling, you're going to have wheezing that you can hear, laryngeal edema, you'll have the voice changes, vomiting. So they're objective things. There's always a temporal relationship between the ingestion of the food and when the symptoms happen. Probably a third of the time, individuals that think they have food allergy, you can rule it out with that simple question. How soon after you ate the food did the symptoms happen? And then like hives that we talked about, how long the hives last? If they last a couple of hours, it could be a food. Still pretty unlikely. If it lasts overnight, it's not a food. Most people that have hives, it's not a couple of hours. It lasts a day or days or weeks. But they associate in an event that happened at the beginning. They may have had peanuts the day before, started having hives the next day. They last for 2 weeks. Well, you ask two simple questions. When do the symptoms start after the ingestion? And that tells you they're not related. And then how long the hives lasted, which was days to weeks. Again, it's not food related. So there's simple questions with objective symptoms that will get you there most of the time.
So give us a picture of the most common story. So someone eats peanuts, and give us just an image of the most common patient that would present with this.
So the most common, or one of the more common ones, because milk and egg allergy are actually more common than peanut, but the common history you would hear for peanut allergy is a child between 12 and 18 months, the mother's breastfeeding, and the first time the child had peanut butter on a mother's finger or a peanut butter cracker, within about 15 or 20 minutes, the child had vomiting and hives. That's the most common history. So they're both pretty objective symptoms. There's a temporal relationship between the first time the food was eaten and the symptoms they're having. It doesn't happen after a child's eaten the food a whole lot of times.
And what about milk? Because you mentioned milk and egg, and we see that or we hear of that a lot from parents say, my child can't have milk or can't have cow's milk.
Right. And it's the same thing. All the mammalian milks are the same. Goats or cows or whatever animal you want to get milk
from. But not soy milk.
Soy milk's different. It's not from an animal. It's from a plant. But all the mammalian milks are just as allergic to each other. We get a common history of a child having spitting up, and they're on this formula and then that formula, and then they work their way to goat's milk, and they say goat's milk's not allergenic. Well, actually, what happened, they've already outgrown it by the time they get to goat's milk, which is, you know, 12, 15 months. That's what happens.
So I know we're going to need to take a break, but speaking of outgrowing, how long do these things typically last?
So the prevalence of food allergy in the first couple, 3 years of life is between 4 and 6%. By the time you get to school age, then you're talking about 2 to 3%. So milk and egg allergy, a third of the time are gone by school age, say ages 5 or 6. 80% of the time they're gone by mid-adolescence. So that's for milk and egg and wheat and soy. For peanuts, fish, shellfish and other tree nuts, it's the reverse. About 80% of them, once they begin, are there for life. Why the differences in the two groups, we're not really sure, but that's fairly well documented.
And do any of them come on as you get older? In other words, you did fine with shellfish and peanuts the first 10 times you had them, but then all of a sudden you develop allergies. Can it go that direction too?
It can, but it's really unusual. Probably the only common one out of that is shellfish and shrimp. a 25 to 40-year-old that's eaten shrimp their whole life can have reactions to them. Recently, one of the Minnesota Vikings football players had an allergic reaction, anaphylaxis, at lunch to a shrimp salad. He'd eaten shrimp his whole life. He's from Texas. And it happens, but it's really, really, really uncommon.
Well, hopefully they were not playing the Charlotte Panthers at the time, but we need to take a short break. But when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Wesley Burks, about food allergies. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the chairman of the Department of Pediatrics and national expert on food allergies, Dr. Wesley Burks. And Dr. Burks, right before we broke, I think we were understanding kind of a little bit of the natural history of food allergies. And one of the things that oftentimes we get asked, and I'm not sure I know the right answer, is how often can you diagnose it? Let's say you really do suspect it is a food allergy. Can you pinpoint it, and how do you do that?
Okay. Now, I think that diagnosis of food allergy is like putting a puzzle together, and most of the pieces are your clinical history. So what food is it that you think caused the reactions? What's that temporal relationship between when you ate the food and the symptoms? How long did the symptoms actually last, and what were the symptoms? Those kind of straightforward questions get you the answer almost all the time. The diagnostic tests that we have, like a skin prick test or a blood test, only help kind of lock the puzzle together. They're one out of the multitude of pieces, and it's the smallest piece. It helps lock it. It helps confirm it, but it's not the test that says, yes, you're allergic or no, you're not. The clinical history does that.
And I think that's tough for parents. They want like an objective test to say, is this this or not? So how do you approach that with patients in terms of exuding confidence in the diagnosis when sometimes there's not that blood test or exact test to confirm it?
Okay, no, it's a good question. I think the test that we have, the way I try to explain it, look for IgE, which is in a protein that your body makes if you're allergic to something. And the test is a really good negative predictor. If you have a child who's never had milk or egg and they have both at the same time and they have clinical symptoms 15 minutes later of hives and wheezing, we can't tell by our clinical history which food. So we do a prick test or a blood test to both foods. If one of them is negative, it's not that food. It's a really, really good negative predictor. The positive predictive value, if you take all positive tests, is about 50% if you don't take the history into account. But if you take a history of what I just described, a child that had milk and egg, negative test to egg, positive test to milk, and then you go back and give that child milk, then 99% of the time they'll react. Because you've skewed what you're going to do based on your clinical history to then do that last piece of the puzzle to lock it together, and you know what the diagnosis is. So you should be able to, most of the time, make an appropriate diagnosis.
So let's say there's a diagnosis been made. Someone comes to the school system, to the doctor. They've got a peanut allergy. Walk us through the type of education that you really have to do and that we should be doing with our listeners to really help them manage this in a way that's safe.
Okay. So the right treatment plan for a child with, say, we'll talk about peanut allergy specifically right now, is to help that child and the family avoid the food. And then
that's not so easy.
Then we'll walk through that. If you do then have an actual reaction, that you have a plan, like an asthma action plan, a food allergy action plan, that you can write down for them what to do. No medical judgment. If A happens, they do B. If C happens, they do D. And A is if they have a few hives in their face, you take an antihistamine. If they have systemic symptoms, they want to get epinephrine and antihistamine and go to the doctor. And so that's relatively straightforward. You tell them that probably half the time in the next couple of years, your child's likely to have an accidental reaction. It's just going to happen. Not to depress them, but so they're prepared. They know what they need to do. So that's the right treatment right now. There are studies going on here nationally, internationally, to try to come up with a proactive treatment, but we're not there yet.
Like what?
There are types of immunotherapy studies that are available, both oral, actually giving the food, sublingual, that's a concentrate of that food. There are studies that apply a patch with that food in them, other types of more sophisticated molecular studies. Same concept, low dose, high dose, change your immune system over time. So those studies, they're about 10 years into it. And the way I think about it is that you have three phases of FDA studies. We're really at the end of phase two, and phase three studies need to be done. And then if it still works, then you have a treatment option.
But it looks promising?
I think overall it does. It's much more promising than we thought even 7 or 8 years ago.
So this is really hard for parents, I know. And the schools, I think, have adapted and become more comfortable with plans in schools. But in terms of retesting, if most children are going to grow out of it, how do you advise? They can't help the accidental exposure, but how do you advise a controlled way to retest?
Okay, so for the first, say, a child age two that comes in with any peanut, milk, or egg allergy, about yearly it's good to retest them up until school age. And then you know whether they're in that group is either outgrowing it or not outgrowing it. And then after that, every couple of years is probably sufficient just to see if they've outgrown it at that point. You don't wait until the test is negative. So a skin test that would be predictive that you would react would be like 10 millimeters of swelling. So they start out with that at age two. At age seven, if that skin test is 3 millimeters, there's an 80% chance they've already outgrown it.
Wow.
So you just watch that over time, not till it goes away, but till it diminishes significantly. And then it's time to help them reintroduce the food, often in an office, just in an open feeding. But then you can help them get it back into their diet.
Well, one of the things I know, Dr. Berg, that you're president-elect of the American Academy of Allergy and Asthma and Immunology. So you're traveling. You're seeing and hearing about this across the world, probably. Mm-hmm. Help us understand, what do we know by studying this issue in other cultures? Is this something unique to the Western culture, the Western diet, to vegetarian-based diets in India or Japan? What do we know?
Okay, so it's a really good question. One, there was speculation for a long time that peanuts were different in different cultures. They're pretty much the same proteins.
The South Georgia peanuts are the same as the peanuts in
South Africa and Italy. You've had them sent from there. They all look pretty much the same in proteins. That really, it goes back to the diet part and when peanuts are introduced in the diet and then how they're introduced. So the what you're allergic to is a protein, and if you introduce into the diet, the food, not intact protein, but protein that's been disrupted either in a paste or some heated fashion early in life, then you're less likely to develop the allergic reaction. So if you look at even India has increasing peanut allergy. So the cultures, like the Asian cultures that we thought 15 years ago didn't have peanut allergy, there are lots of reports, lots of physicians that we work with coming out of those cultures that they see it now. So it really
so it's not the hormones in the meat that you eat that somehow alter the antibodies or something
no,
like that?
No, it's partly your genes, like any allergic disease, and partly the time that you're exposed to that allergen and then how you're exposed to it. So a disrupted protein that's in peptides that's given early in life, you're much more likely to become tolerant, never develop an allergy than if you get intact protein, which is what peanut butter is, and you wait later in life to give it.
Fascinating. The other concern that I have is the issue of a stigma. So a lot of these children, especially if they have more severe allergies, you can't sit at the same table as the other kids. And parents are concerned about how do I teach my child to take it seriously, but also to still be able to play with her friends without worry. How do you counsel people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think one thing that really helps is to understand how you have a reaction. And to have a life-threatening, life-ending reaction to peanuts, you have to eat the food. It's not by smelling it, not by touching it, not by being in the same ballpark with it. That's not going to cause you to have a life-ending reaction. And that perception or misperception is huge. So if you can help them understand that, that's a big deal. And then within the school system, to help them work with a child so that they're not next to somebody that's going to, like, stick their food in their mouth. Mm-hmm. And you can do that lots of different ways. Just like in clinic today, I had a conversation with an 8-year-old to help him understand this same issue, that he has a certain color hair, he has certain color eyes, and he's unique. And he has a reaction to a tree nut. His brother has a different color hair, different color eyes, and he doesn't have a reaction to treating it. They're both unique individuals. And to try to help them understand that, it's an easy thing to talk about, but it's really important for a child, but particularly a parent, to understand.
So this is, again, a growing issue. It's a worldwide issue. You've been doing some leading research for a couple of decades. In our closing time, help us understand, what is your belief of what the next 10 to 20 years, are we likely to make some significant strides forward in the treatment or prevention?
I think the two big areas that there will be changes in the next 10 years, one, there will be the first generation of treatment that will come out. I have no idea what it will look like. There are different options that are coming along. But I do think there will be an active treatment, and we'll understand those that we can treat and make the reaction go away, those that we can treat to just provide protection for them. So that will happen. And then with studies going on now in the U.S. and Europe, then looking at the time of introduction of a food into a child's diet, particularly a Western diet, whether it's Western Europe, U.S., Canada, Australia, will know better about when the right time to give the child the food is, so they're less likely to ever develop an allergic reaction. So those two things will be different in 10 years.
Well, that is exciting, and I'm sure many of our listeners out there affected by food allergies and their families will be eager to see the fruits of that research. We've been talking with Dr. Wesley Burks, expert in food allergies. Thank you for taking time to be with us and to educate us and our listeners.
And we'll also hopefully put up some information about the Department of Pediatrics and the ability for anyone who is in the region who would like to get more information where they can maybe find it. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Adam and Christy.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. On 97.9 FM, WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have your own questions you want us to address, please send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can send us to us on our health app. Lots of different ways. And Christy, we have some wonderful questions today about some really complex questions. Let's dive right into our very first health call question from a listener who's suffered an unfortunate medical condition.
My husband had a stroke several weeks ago. They took great care of him in the hospital, but we were sent home with so few instructions or guidance or psychological support. What should we do about driving, work? Is it safe to have sex? He's a little depressed and we would like some help.
Life after stroke and questions about what to do. I'm so sorry that your husband had this experience several weeks ago, and also sorry that you're left with so many questions. It sounds like you feel like you have a lot of unanswered questions and maybe haven't been guided enough.
Well, and we would like to think that we do a great job all the time with all of the issues that are important to our listeners and our patients. And I think this is a great example of where we can improve upon. You know, Christy, we have these patient-centered medical homes where we're trying to have these team approaches, and we're trying to bring psychiatry and psychology into our outpatient teams. This is maybe a situation where we need to have a neurology patient-centered medical home where you bring it to the inpatient service, because we need psychologists and psychiatrists really involved, because these are the questions you're answering. They're complex questions. We hope they would have been addressed in the hospital, but we could help address them in the outpatient setting.
It's true. I mean, these are questions that the neurologist or a stroke expert, as well as a physical therapist and a social worker and a primary care doctor, really should be working together to guide you. I totally agree, Adam. One of the things that struck me, there are many questions in here, and we won't be able to do it justice today, but depression is really common after a major illness. And I feel like we have some systems in our patient-centered medical home to try to pick up on this and screen people appropriately. But in this case, talking to your doctor and being able to process some of those feelings are really, really important for early treatment.
I agree, Christine. I think it'd be useful for us to maybe see, where is this happening really great? Who who's doing a really great job with this. And maybe we can talk with them about these issues, because these are not just about after a stroke, but after any serious illness like this. These are the same questions that could come up about driving and work and sexual relations. And there's not a single right answer here, but these are the right questions. So we encourage you to work with your primary care physician to get what you need and to help get some of these answers. Thank you so much for this question.
Sorry we don't have direct answers, but we are going to do a show on this. This is important. Let's take our next house call question about a cervical disc and pain in your neck.
I had the sudden onset several weeks ago of pain in my neck. My doctor said it was a cervical disc. I have been in bed for several weeks and it is still really painful and I cannot function like this. They told me they would not consider surgery for several months. What can I do?
It does sound painful. I have had some arthritis in my neck, Christy, for years. I might have had a disc once. It was so, so painful. I can relate to the discomfort here of our listener. And the question, though, really is, when do you need surgery?
Well, and how do you make it? If they say it'd be a few months till they consider it, how do you make it that long when it hurts that bad? And that is a really, really tough thing to do. The general recommendations are, of course, things that probably don't sound very good if you're hurting that bad, like the anti-inflammatories or maybe injections can make a difference.
Sometimes the steroids are used and other oral medications, the physical therapy, some sort of cervical collar, traction, all these conservative measures. But boy, if you're in bed, you're not getting better, boy, you need an advocate for you to know and help decide when is surgery right. I don't think we can answer that question, but we encourage you to really go back and talk with the provider, whether it's the orthopedist, your primary care doctor, or the neurosurgeon, whoever is helping you work through this, because if you're not getting better, keep getting answers.
Absolutely. And hopefully also with a team approach, sometimes with a pain specialist or an anesthesiologist, as well as with a neurologist and your primary care doctor, you can come up with some plan to get you through, because this sounds like you're in a tough spot. Yeah. We hope you're better soon.
And we're glad that the doctor didn't recommend surgery immediately on the other extreme. But on the other hand, several months, you maybe need follow-up, but maybe on a weekly basis. Good luck. Thank you for your question. Let's listen to our very next house call.
I have a new condition called pulmonary fibrosis, and I am told I will need to take prednisone for the rest of my life. I've heard that prednisone is dangerous. What should I know to protect myself?
Prednisone, that's that steroid that comes in the form of a pill that people take. It helps to reduce inflammation, but it can have a lot of side effects, and I think you're appropriately concerned about thinking about taking this forever is a big decision.
And it can be dangerous. And on the other hand, it may be life-saving. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I were stranded on that desert island, Christy, and I could only have three medicines to take with me for years, I probably would, one of them would be prednisone, because it is such a good medication. But boy, what can you do to help reduce the chances of having the bad side effects of long-term prednisone? What ideas do you have?
Well, one of the big dangers is that it can cause early thinning of your bones or osteoporosis over time, put you at higher risk for that. So extra important to exercise, weight-bearing exercise, take calcium, vitamin D, and to get your bones screened, because you may need to be on some of those medicines called bisphosphonates, which can help strengthen your bones to prevent fractures or breaks in those bones.
Another problem is a lot of times people with prednisone gain weight, and they can become diabetic or their diabetes can get worse. So coming up with a plan early on to avoiding weight, you may need to be seeing a nutritionist and being on some sort of calorie restrictions or a more reduced calorie diet so you don't gain weight over a long period of time.
And you can also work with your doctor to take the lowest dose of prednisone that you need to help your lungs from this pulmonary fibrosis, but also the lowest dose required, so that hopefully you'd have the least chances of these big side effects.
And there are newer drugs that sometimes people use with pulmonary fibrosis, but those are also a little dangerous and have side effects. And I don't know if they're sometimes better or worse than the prednisone, but you know what? That's where the specialist will really help you make that decision. Thanks so much for a great question. Let's listen to our very last house call.
I got a splinter in my finger recently. I asked three friends how to get it out, and I got three different answers. I finally went to my family doctor, who got it out quickly with a pair of nail clippers cutting gently on the top of the splinter. It worked like a charm. Now I have my own recipe to pass on.
Well, I'm getting better at splinters, not because of medical school or residency training, but my training as a mom.
Ooh, so what is your preferred approach to getting splinters out, Christy? And have you ever heard of our listener's approach?
Yes, although I'm hoping they didn't actually cut the top of the splinter, but they sort of pinched it gently with the nail clippers.
Yeah, I've heard that you can like take off the skin on top of the splinter, and it's an easy way rather than taking a small scalpel blade, which is kind of scary to people, not everyone has. Yeah, you don't want to push that splinter down. Good point.
But I typically will try to milk it out with my fingers and try to push and squeeze and see if I can get it out just enough to a point that with a really good pair of tweezers, I can get it out. But sometimes my emergency medicine husband gets out the scalpel.
Ooh. Well, I think we want to hear about all the recipes out there that our listeners have about getting splinters out. Let's have a splinter sharing party, and please send us those. We'll talk about some of them on the show. But it sounds like this is one of those things that doctors have some answers. Moms and dads may have some other answers too.
All right. Thank you so much for your house call questions today. We've talked a little bit about care and life and challenges after a stroke, about
cervical disc and really needing to get regular follow-up until you get better,
about prednisone and how trying to guard against some of the side effects,
and about the splinter recipe network that we're creating.
We're going to create it on our blog. Go check it out. All right. Thank you for your questions and for joining us today. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health. And we want you to share with us your stories. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, our health app, and be a part of our community.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Wesley Burks. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.